Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Kathleen Fitzgerald. She's the African Wildlife Federation Vice President for Conservation Strategy, Nairobi, Kenya. That's www.awf.org. She has 22 years experience directing landscape scale conservation and community engagement. Prior to overseeing AWF's conservation strategy, Kathleen led AWF's land program, helping to advance AWF's land conservation projects across Africa, including establishing community conservancies, developing carbon mitigation projects, securing wildlife corridors, and helping to improve management of protected areas and community lands. Prior to moving to Africa 7 years ago, she facilitated dozens of land transactions to establish conservation areas and co-founded a regional wilderness land trust. She holds a Master of Science in Botany from the Field Naturalist Program at the University of Vermont and completed her final research on wolves in Canada, has an undergraduate degree in environmental studies and government. So first, thank you for your work and thank you for being on the program.
Thank you. It's great to be here, Derek.
Well, thanks. Tell people about your work and the state of the wild in Africa.
Okay, thanks. Well, so I work for the African Wildlife Foundation, and AWF was founded 53 years ago. So we're an old international conservation organization. And what makes us unique is we are probably the largest international organization that only focuses on Africa. So we're solely Africa focused, and our headquarters is in Nairobi, Kenya. And AWF works in approximately 16 countries in sub-Saharan Africa. And our mission is working together with the people of Africa to ensure that the wildlife and wildlands endure forever. And AWF, when we were started, we were actually started as the African Wildlife Leadership Foundation. And it was at the time when a number of African countries were becoming independent. And the question emerged, if Africa is going to retain its wildlife and wild lands, then where are the African conservation leaders? And so AWF was founded to cultivate conservation leaders. Now, over the last 5 decades in Africa, a lot has changed and a lot has happened. Leadership and African leadership is still a key critical component of the organization, but we have expanded quite a bit, as you might imagine, over 50 years. And really, as our mission states, our focus is protecting the wildlife, protecting the wildlands, and doing it in a way that benefits people. So we're science-based, and we work with local communities, government, private sector partners to derive creative mechanisms to protect land and secure wildlife. And the reality in Africa is you have high levels of poverty, and most of the rural communities living with wildlife, they suffer from wildlife. You know, elephants are renowned for raiding gardens and farms, and lions are renowned for killing cows. So we work with local communities to make sure that there are mitigation measures to essentially help them live in a positive way with wildlife, because it's critical to the long-term sustainability of wildlife.
So what would that mean in terms of mitigation? Like, what does that mean you do with a community?
So we do a number of things. I mean, if you look at the long-term protection of wildlife in Africa, it's obviously dependent, number one, on good protected areas. So one of the key things that we do is we support African governments in establishing but also managing good protected areas, parks, sanctuaries, reserves. And what I mean by good is, you know, when you go to a country like South Africa, for example, they have a robust economy. They have a very dynamic tourism industry. And so their parks operate very well. They're able to protect wildlife. They're able to manage the park. But if you go to a place like CAR or Democratic Republic of Congo, we have a big program in the Congo, their parks are less functioning simply because they don't have tourism. They don't have economies that can support conservation. So in terms of protected areas, we're working with governments to try to support those protected areas. Now, just like in the United States, you can have a great protected area network, but if they're not connected or buffered by compatible management, they're not going to be able to achieve their conservation objectives. So when I talk about working with communities, mainly these are communities that live outside of protected areas, live in corridors, dispersal areas, and we work with them, for example, to create community conservancies. It's a very positive way to protect land and benefit communities. So, for example, in southern Kenya, you have Amboseli National Park, which is on the border of Kenya and Tanzania, spectacular park, well known for its elephant population. There's about 1,500 elephants that move back and forth between northern Tanzania and southern Kenya. But the park is too small. It's spectacular, but too small to support viable populations of wildlife. So what we've done in that situation is worked with the pastoralists outside of the park. They've created their own conservancies, so they financially benefit from the tourism that takes place there. We have a payment for ecosystem service scheme with them, so they're actually paid to maintain wildlife on their land. And it's a benefit for the park. As I said, if that dispersal area, if that corridor was not protected, the park wouldn't survive. And vice versa. If the park wasn't there, you wouldn't have people coming to these conservancies. So it's really a complementary dynamic.
So, how would you help, lions and communities in a cattle-based community?
Great question. So lions, of course, are probably one of the most charismatic species in Africa. And like elephants and rhinos, actually, they're under threat, quite severe threat, actually. Their population numbers have plummeted over the last three decades, and their numbers right now are less than 24,000 on the entire continent. There is a market for lion products, with the Asian tiger now very diminished. The Asians are now seeking other products, and they are looking for lion bones. In South Africa, for example, there was quite a large a bust for an Asian market for lion bones. But the bigger issue for lions in Africa is habitat loss as well as human-wildlife conflict. So if you're a pastoralist and your cow is eaten or your goat is eaten, there will be retaliatory killing. So some of the things that we do to prevent that is predator-proof bomas, for example. So your typical Maasai will keep their cows inside a corral, made of sticks and wood, and they'll put acacia, which is a local tree that has big thorns, they'll put that around it. But it's quite easy for the cows, when they get spooked, they'll actually kick through that boma, and they'll go out and the lion will eat the cow. So very simple and very cheap, you can actually reinforce that boma so the cows can't get out, and then the lions can. The lions don't get them. So that's a simple method that we've used. There have been some other creative things done where actually the community I mentioned earlier that we helped set up a conservancy, they've actually taken a portion of the funds that they raise from that conservancy and they've put it into a consolation scheme, which means if someone loses their cow, they can go to the committee and apply, and they can get some, not full compensation, but a consolation for the loss of that livestock. It's like an insurance scheme. And the fact that they were the ones that created it and set it up was fantastic.
I know that in the United States West, one of the problems is this is not just economic, that if some cattle rancher or sheep rancher is running cows or sheep on especially public lands in the West and a cow gets killed by a wolf in Washington State, for example, they're paid twice market value, but a lot of the ranchers hate wolves so much that they will refuse the payment and instead insist that the wolf be killed, which makes no economic sense. But the point is there's this among a lot of ranchers in the West, there's a deep hatred of wolves. And is there a similar hatred of lions among the pastoralists there, or is this more of a uniquely American thing?
I think it's more an American thing. I mean, what's interesting, if you look at pastoralists, so take East Africa, Kenya and Tanzania, the Maasai, you know, they have lived for centuries with wildlife. Now, part of their culture is that they don't eat wildlife. So when you go to the Congo, for example, where we have a program, anything that moves is eaten. And the bushmeat trade is a huge problem. But in East Africa, because of that culture of not eating wildlife, the wildlife has done fairly well. Now with lions, again, with the Maasai, it's part of their culture, to respect the lion. Now that said, part of their tradition when they become warriors is killing lions. You go out as a boy when you're supposed to become a warrior and you go and you kill a lion and it shows you're ready for adulthood. And there have been some creative alternatives that have been proposed. So I would say no, there's not a hatred. Now, is there frustration? Absolutely. And not just with the lion. I mean, when an elephant comes in and takes out your entire crop, it's very difficult to maintain a respect for an animal, that, especially in an area where poverty is such a big issue.
So one of the things that we hear about a lot in Africa, I mean, if anybody hears anything about threats to African wildlife, we always hear the P word. So can you talk a little bit about poaching?
Sure. And I think it's important, you know, some of the issues that we were just speaking about, retaliatory killing. I mentioned habitat loss. The poaching crisis is taking place amidst all of these other dynamics, which is really important to remember. I mean, Africa is a huge continent that is undergoing enormous change. You know, when people think of Africa, everyone has a different impression, but 7 of the 10 fastest growing economies in the world are in Africa. So what that means is Africa is changing at a pace never seen before. What that means is roads, highways, railways, mining. It's just developing fast. And what that also means is there's a habitat loss like we've never seen before. So wildlife is already under enormous pressure from all of those dynamics. And now on top of that, there is a major poaching crisis. And the last time Africa saw a crisis like this was in the late 80s. And I don't know, you may remember AWF coined a campaign called Only Elephants Wear Ivory. And at the, it was a major poaching crisis, but the positive side is it stopped. And we were able to stop it. CITES, which is, you know, the essential, the international trade, the convention for international trade, essentially shut down the market. And so when people get caught up in the current poaching crisis, it's good to remember that we can stop it. But what's happening now is it's no longer small scale poaching. Africa's always had small scale poaching. You know, and it could be for meat, it could be for ivory, it could be for rhino horn. But over the last couple of years, it has ramped up, to an unsustainable pace. It's completely unsustainable. And we are now at a tipping point for species like the rhino and the elephant. And it's essentially, it's a multi-billion dollar illicit industry. You know, it's estimated at about $10 million a year. And it ranks up there with other international crime industries like drug trafficking and arms dealing. And what's driving it is a demand from Asia. So there is a significant demand in Asia for
rhino horn as well as ivory, and that's what's driving it. You know, with Asia growing and expanding, and you have this new elite, and you've got people with money, that is what is driving the demand. And what it means for wildlife, as I said, is wildlife is at a tipping point. 2012 estimates for elephants are about 25,000 elephants were killed. So that, you know, if that comes out to about one elephant killed every 15 minutes. And then for rhino, it's just as severe. There's about two rhinos lost every 12 hours in Africa. And the rhino numbers, for example, there are two rhino species in Africa. There's the black rhino and the white rhino. And the numbers of rhinos, there's less than 25,000 rhino left in all of Africa. So again, we are at a tipping point. In South Africa alone, for example, and these are, you know, they're numbers that should make people pause. We lost about 1,000 rhino last year. And what's interesting is if you look at, for example, in 2007, 13 rhino were lost in an entire year. So you're looking at a, you know, 7,000 plus percent increase in poaching. It's basically out of control.
So can we back up for a second? And sure. When you talk about these numbers, I think it's really important for people to have also some historical or prehistorical baselines. Do we have any idea of the numbers? Like, what was it you said, 24,000 lions now? Is that what you said?
Yes.
So do we have – I know that lions were all the way up into Greece. And I don't know if – did you know that there were hippos on the Thames, by the way?
No, I didn't.
Yeah, I just found that out not very long ago. And they were actually killed pre-Roman. They were killed with the advent of agriculture. Very, very interesting to me. But anyway,
all right.
So do we have any pre-conquest numbers of any of those species you listed? Elephants, rhinos, and lions?
Sure. So elephant, for example, I mentioned, you know, the last poaching crisis for elephant. Really, it was about a decade. It went from, you know, let's say 1979 to 1989. And the elephant population then, and that's not that long ago, was approximately 1.3 million. Now, currently, and again, it's very difficult to get accurate numbers, and so I'll give you the range. Currently, the 2007 continental census of elephants it was from 470,000 elephants to about 690,000. Some recent numbers have come out, and it puts the low at about 420,000 to 650. So again, you've gone from 1989 at 1.3 million to current estimates. If you take the average, you know, it's about 525,000. Now I say it's difficult. Certainly the savanna elephants are very easy to count, but go to the DRC, the Democratic Republic of Congo, extremely difficult because those are forest elephants. And the numbers in DRC, the estimates are staggering in terms of loss. So it's a significant, it's halved, which is huge.
And that is just since 1979. It's like, I just recently read, actually a couple years ago, read that songbirds in the eastern United States had collapsed by about, depending on the species, collapsed like 40 to 70% in the last 40 years.
Right.
And I was freaking out about that until I realized that that 40% collapse is after Silent Spring. So that 40% collapse is on top of a previous, you know, 70% collapse or whatever.
Right.
So,
right.
The point is that that's really dreadful, and in addition, that 1979 estimate would already be a grossly reduced estimate.
Exactly. And again, you know, these are poaching numbers, or these, you know, the loss is more recently. So, for example, the 1,000 rhinos killed in South Africa, that's poaching. And as I was saying, add on top of that habitat loss, and you have a severe crisis. Now, you know, I don't want to be all doom and gloom because I think there are ways that it can be stopped. And again, it was stopped before, so it can stop now. And what we're doing as an organization is really looking at three things. We're looking at stopping the killing, stopping the trafficking, and stopping the demand. Because unless you get all three of those things, it will continue. So when I say stopping the killing, what I'm talking about is your average ranger that's out in the field trying to protect wildlife. You know, go into a remote park. If it's not well funded, they have bad weapons, not good gear, and they're dealing with poachers now who are very well organized, very well equipped. They don't have a chance. The poachers are 10 steps ahead. So we're trying to equip, rangers on the ground. So buying night vision goggles, we helped buy a helicopter for Sabi Sands Reserve, which is on the western side of Kruger National Park, which has been one of the most hardest hit for rhino. Getting uniforms, getting camping equipment, just equipping the guys that are on the ground, frankly, the ones that are risking their lives every day to protect the wildlife. So that's really stopping the killing on the ground. Now, when they succeed and they get an elephant or they get a rhino and they, you know, again, it's, as I said, it's extremely sophisticated. In South Africa, they're flying in with helicopters, they're dropping to the ground, they're taking the rhino horn and they're gone. I mean, you have like 5 seconds to deal with these issues.
So this is not just, this is in no way, this is completely different than local people completely driven by poverty to go, you know, eat bushmeat or something. This is an entirely different situation than that.
Yeah, you're dealing with ringleaders that it's an organized crime. And that's in part of it, to be honest. You know, so in East Africa recently, you've probably heard there's been a lot of media attention around the terrorism threat from Al-Shabaab. Which is a terrorist organization in Somalia, and they've been responsible for a number of instances in Kenya. Now, there's evidence that they are funding their terrorism activity through ivory. We've just gotten information, the Lord's Resistance Army, which is the infamous Joseph Kony, who operated out of northern Uganda, again, funding terrorist activities through ivory. It is a valuable product, and they're using it to make money. So, yes, they hire the local guys, but the bottom line, you catch a local guy, there's 100 standing behind him ready to go. It's really the ringleaders that need to be stopped, and that's, you know, when I mentioned the stop the killing, stop the trafficking, stopping the demand. The trafficking is an area. So, for example, you get the horn, you got to get it out of the country somehow. So we're targeting ports and we're targeting airports. We're providing sniffer dogs at airports, for example. You know, they don't have good x-ray screening. So it's, you know, when you think about Africa, you've got to think some countries, are cash strapped. They don't have sophisticated technology, so it's fairly easy to get things out of some countries. And so we're trying to equip them so that it's not that easy. We're also training judiciary. So let's say best case scenario, you catch a poacher and you throw him in jail. Well, until Kenya recently changed their wildlife policy, you basically got a slap on the wrist, you got a small fine, and you were out. So Kenya's actually increased their penalty, which is great. But we're training judiciary so that they're aware of the laws, that you can prosecute wildlife crimes and they can get a severe punishment. You can actually prosecute on trespassing. You can prosecute on illegal arms. I mean, there are many ways to say to others, this is a serious crime and we're treating it seriously. And there have recently been some good prosecutions. The Taiman, for example, in South Africa was recently prosecuted for 40 years. That sends the right message. And lastly is the demand. I mean, people are buying it. The price is driving the killing. And so what we're doing, we've partnered with a great organization called Wild Aid, and we're doing public service announcements all over China, Vietnam. Vietnam is the number one consumer of rhino horn. And essentially saying if the buying stops, the killing can too. And we've had great partnerships with celebrities from China, from Vietnam. So Yao Ming, who's a famous basketball player who people might know because he was instrumental in the shark fin soup campaign, he's joined the campaign. Jackie Chan has done a number of public service announcements. And the bottom line is just making people aware. And what we found was in the surveys that we've done is that most Chinese are unaware that it's illegal. Most are unaware that when they consume rhino horn, you know, for a hangover cure or for an aphrodisiac, that that comes from an animal that was killed. Most people are not aware of that, which I think is a positive thing, because it says if they become aware and if they know that they're consuming something that was murdered, then they might respond differently. So hopefully these public service announcements will make a difference. But again, it's also, it's got to happen at a policy level, and we just have to shut the market down.
Speaking of publicizing these things, I just heard, my mom has Netflix, and I just heard that there's a program called Virunga, and I'm wondering if it's any good.
I don't know it.
Oh, it's about
Virungas.
It's about poaching in Africa. I know that. And it's about rangers who – it's a Netflix show, you know, one of the originals. And it's about – I don't know. Basically, all I know is sort of the tagline. It's about a group of rangers stopping poachers. That's all I know.
Hmm. Well, I haven't heard of it, but it's great. I mean, the more people become aware of what's happening, and I'm curious if it's – so Virunga National Park in Rwanda – phenomenal park. It's part of a transboundary protected area between Uganda, Rwanda, and Democratic Republic of Congo. And there's a great success story where the mountain gorilla was, you know, on the brink of extinction. And now the mountain gorilla is one of the only great apes that are increasing in number. It's an incredible success story. And a lot of the rangers that protect the mountain gorillas are former poachers that have been trained and are now paid to protect them. It's a great story.
So how you've mentioned a couple times that poaching was stopped in the 80s, and then you just mentioned this is a success story, and you've talked about the three avenues that you're approaching currently, but can you tell more the sort of nuts and bolts of, like, that particular story? How did that success story take place? How did that turn around?
Well, the interesting thing about mountain gorilla, and it does go back in that case to economics. And, you know, I will say I'm one in the United States that was never a fan of the statement, wildlife must pay. It drove me crazy. However, in Africa,
I don't like it either.
Yeah. In Africa, it does, because you're dealing with, a population that's poor. Food security is a major issue in Africa, and it does have to pay, because otherwise people will kill wildlife to eat it. They'll kill wildlife to protect their farms. They will kill wildlife to protect their cows, which provides nourishment. It's survival. That's what it is. So with the mountain gorilla, people pay $750 to spend 1 hour with the mountain gorilla. And it's an incredible experience. Rwanda is a country that's known for lack of corruption, which is great. So the money that goes into the park stays in the park. It pays the rangers. And the local communities are benefiting from employment.
They get a percentage of the revenue. It's a great story. And they're incentivized. They are incentivized to protect the mountain gorilla and to abide by park regulations. They know that the people coming to see the forest are coming to see the mountain gorilla. And that incentivizes people not to poach and not to infringe on habitat. And that's how it's working.
So how about with the rhinos and the elephants? How did the 1980s crisis, how did the 1980s crisis end, and what caused it to come back?
Essentially what happened in 1989, after it was a decade of severe elephant poaching, CITES, as I mentioned, Convention of International Trade for Endangered Species, because of enormous, and it was public pressure. You know, I remember those campaigns, only elephants should wear ivory, and it was very well publicized because of public and international pressure. CITES listed the elephant on Appendices 1, which essentially said no trade. There's no market, there's no trade, shut it down, and it got shut down. So the prices then collapsed, and there was no market. Now, why has it come back? It's interesting because there has been some regulated trade. So, for example, in certain countries in Africa, you can, you know, if I'm an American and I want to go hunt an elephant and bring back the ivory, I can do that. I can get a permit. It's very well regulated, and in some countries, Namibia is a good example, it does support conservation. However, recently, because of the demand that's coming from Asia, there's a black market for ivory and rhino. And what that has done is it's confused the marketplace. The demand has accelerated the poaching. There were some, as you're probably aware, many countries have stockpiles of ivory. So these are pieces of ivory that have been found in the field from naturally deceased elephants. And these stockpiles are just, they're sitting in warehouses. And some countries have said, we want to sell these stockpiles to support conservation. And there have been some cases where countries have been permitted to sell. And the evidence is fairly strong, which shows that when those sales took place, poaching increased, prices increased. It confused the market.
Well, that's what I was going to say, is that I remember the arguments against allowing them to sell the stockpiles is that if you allow them to sell the stockpiles, it will do exactly what it's done.
Right, right. So we, you know, the African Wildlife Foundation is in favor of countries destroying their stockpiles. And as you're probably aware, the United States destroyed a stockpile in Colorado. Hong Kong destroyed a stockpile. Kenya has destroyed a stockpile. So again, we believe at this point, with the crisis where it's at, there needs to be a clear and unambiguous message that says, it's just got to stop. Because it is true, there are certain countries that manage their wildlife very well. Look at, you know, if you look at the transboundary area between Zimbabwe and Botswana and Zambia, they have about 150,000 elephants between those countries in that transboundary area. Now, Zimbabwe historically has allowed hunting, as well as, you know, I had mentioned Namibia earlier. And the damage those elephants have done is quite severe ecologically. So they historically have used hunting as a management tool. Again, you got to look at, with increasing populations, with increasing infrastructure, habitat has become smaller. And so if your populations continue to increase, it is an issue. However, at this time, again, if you allow that in one place and not in the other, the consumer does not know the difference, nor will they. So we're saying it's just got to stop until we can put in mechanisms that can ensure that things are regulated, that there is no corruption in the wildlife trade and trafficking, it has to stop.
So two things. One is that reminds me of something that an anti-slavery activist said about the problem of slavery in chocolate. That he said part of the problem is that the entire global economy acts as a huge money laundering scheme. And so you can never tell whether, I mean, you can work really hard, but it becomes very difficult to tell the source of either the chocolate or in this case ivory or, you know, as we know, the famous example of diamonds.
Right.
It all becomes extremely difficult in that. So I just want to mention that. And then I want to go back to sort of a larger question of, we keep talking about, the people being really poor, and we keep talking about, the increase in infrastructure. And like, I just read something the other day that there are some places where the Maasai are, the governments are attempting to force them off their land to, quote, develop, end quote, geothermal energy. And then we can talk about, you know, cash crops for export and people being forced off their land for that. So I wonder, too, if we can talk about, you know, the poverty. I mean, if we can talk about the whole effects of colonialism and of the transnational, say, agriculture corporations. I won't even finish. Go ahead.
No, you're raising, you know, there's so many dynamics taking place right now. And what you're referring to, we call, it's the new colonialism is what it's being called. And it's essentially foreign governments coming in and buying up large tracts of land. And it stemmed from the food crisis a couple of years ago, and foreign governments realizing, whew, we have an increasing population. We need more land for agriculture. Biofuel is another thing, which is really fueling, no pun intended, this large land acquisition. So what's happening across the continent is staggering. You know, between 2000 and 2010, 134 million hectares were acquired in Africa.
By
foreign companies coming in and buying land. Now, the land tenure system in Africa, it varies from country to country, but, you know, in America, we have title and we have private land and you buy and you sell. Well, in Africa, there's a lot of customary tenure. Which means, you know, in Zambia, for example, the chief is your customary owner. He represents the local culture. In a lot of countries still in Africa, the government still owns the land. So Democratic Republic of Congo is a great example. Ethiopia, same thing. So you have these instances, as you said, where people are getting kicked off their land for these large infrastructure and large-scale acquisitions. Now, the other important thing to remember is if you want to grow something, you're going to go to the most fertile areas, which also means those are the areas that wildlife thrives. So it's creating yet another complex dynamic across the continent because you're getting some land conflict. Water is a major issue in Africa, and as you're doing large-scale agriculture, it also requires a lot of water. So some of the tension that has been created, for example, in southern Tanzania, which is one of the most biologically rich areas, you have large rice plantations, and they're using up a lot of water. And what that means is Ruaha National Park, which hosts an enormous population of elephants, the river's drying up. So in addition to people getting kicked off their land, not having access to water, not being able to get access to good agricultural land, you also have an impact on wildlife. And it's a challenging situation. And the other dynamic that's taking place is A number of governments are permitting resource extraction in national parks at the same time. So it's just a lot is taking place in terms of conservation infrastructure development.
So we've talked, we have like, 6 or 7 or 8 minutes left, and we've talked a fair amount about megafauna, and I'm wondering, you know, some creatures that I don't really understand how they're surviving at all at this point are migratory songbirds, because basically, you know, you can have even a bear, you know, it can still have a, you know, 100 square mile range or whatever it is, and if the rest of the world can kind of go to hell, and as long as that area is intact, it can kind of maybe do a little bit, tiny bit okay. Not really, but the point is that a migratory songbird has to have habitat in the north, it has to have habitat in the middle, it has to have habitat in the south. And so, I'm wondering if you want to talk, there's two things I want to ask you about. The first one is if you want to, and you don't have to, talk about like bird habitat for migratory songbirds. Is there anything you want to say about that?
Well, no, it's a good point. And, you know, Africa's blessed with the most diverse, wildlife species. I mean, from the wildebeest migration in East Africa to, you know, we haven't even touched on the great apes, the most magnificent mammals, to the big herds of elephants. And, you know, we as an organization, try to look at conservation where we're science-based. And so we've looked at the continent, we've prioritized the areas that need to be protected using megafauna as the keystone indicator species. And also we look at a Pan-African view. So we're looking at East Central, West, and Southern Africa. So there are smaller species, there are bird species. While we don't prioritize them, we believe that if you capture enough habitat for these large megafauna, you will in turn capture, you know, maybe 80% of those other species.
So the next thing is, I was talking to somebody a couple of weeks ago about biofuels and the harm caused by them. And one of the things I said is, so, you know, we were talking about some of the megafauna who are harmed by them. And I said, do you want to do a shout out to, you know, somebody else that you particularly really care about who might not get as much attention as others? And she immediately said bacteria, you know, and she was talking about soil bacteria and how she just loves them and how they're harmed by biofuels. So I'm wondering if there's a I think about this a lot in terms of like the Vietnam War Memorial or just, you know, a registry of those who are in trouble. So I'm wondering if there's, in addition to these megafauna, if there's, you know, some particular plant or animal or bacteria for that matter that you just love for whatever reason. Like I really love newts and I really love salmon too. So is there somebody else you just want to, some other non-human that you just want to give, you know, a quick bit of recognition to?
Well, we've got so many exciting new programs, but one of the ones that I'm most excited about is we've just started a conservation program in Ethiopia. And the highlands, and when you were speaking about soil, I was thinking about Ethiopia because, you know, 97% of the highlands of Ethiopia are under cultivation. And we're working in a park called the Simien Mountain National Park, which is probably one of the most spectacular landscapes, in the world. And I did my research when I was in graduate school on wolves, and the Simians is home to the Ethiopian wolf, which is one of the rarest. It is the rarest of all canids. And there's about 450 individuals left in Ethiopia, most endangered carnivore in Africa. So we're working in this park, which is really a spectacular place, and hoping to save a safe haven for the Ethiopian wolf. It's a small wolf. It's similar in size to the red wolf of the United States, but really a special mammal and very threatened.
So if you, you know, I don't know how much you know about my work, but I don't have a problem with doom and gloom as such. I think we need to face the seriousness of the situation. But having said that, what would you, in recognition of the direness of the situation, what would you see as a reasonably, your most positive, somewhat realistic, environmental outcome over the next 5 to 10 years?
Well,
what would you hope for?
What I would hope for, in the short term, we've got to stop the poaching. It just has to stop. So that's one. What we're trying to do across the continent is push an agenda for Africa. So I've mentioned before that the continent is changing and it's growing, and you know, we're not opposed to that. But there's a way that it can grow without sacrificing its wildlife and wildlands. And I don't think that's, you know, a unrealistic scenario. So what we're trying to do is really work with governments to make sure that they're properly planning so that they can keep big wild places as part of their country, so they can keep that natural heritage while simultaneously growing. And for some countries, they recognize it's critical. You know, South Africa, for example, if you look at just the economics around it, they generate a significant amount of revenue from tourism. So that's important. Other countries are recognizing ecosystem services, the value of big wild places for water, for clean air, etc. So I don't think it's unrealistic, and I'm optimistic that we can work with governments to plan well so that we can maintain big wild places, do it in a way where local communities can benefit, and provide enough space for wildlife to survive. I think we can do that.
So two things. One of them is that I misspoke in the introduction and called the African Wildlife Federation. I want to be really clear. You corrected me, and it was the African Wildlife Foundation. I want to make sure people know that.
Thank you.
The second thing the final thing I want to say or ask is, so most of the listeners to this radio program are in North America. What can people do who are, I guess, not in Africa, who are listening to this? What can people do how can they help?
Well, lots of ways. I mean, I think one is becoming aware, which by listening to your show, they're starting to do, which is great. So be aware of what's happening, in Africa. Two, it's important for consumers to be aware that, you know, when they're buying wildlife products, be it ivory or any of the wildlife products, the burden is on them to do the research and to understand where it's coming from and the ramifications. And I think that's very important. Certainly, you know, AWF is a membership organization. Join AWF. Learn about what we're doing, get involved. And also in the United States has been a leader, in raising awareness of these issues. You know, Obama has done a number of things, in the last year around the poaching crisis. Hillary Clinton has raised this issue. And so get involved in the United States in terms of, you know, the United States was one of the biggest consumers of ivory. And so there are ways to get involved in the United States in terms of the impact on Africa. So be aware and get involved.
Well, thank you so much. And thank you for being on the program. Thank you for your work. And I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Kathleen Fitzgerald. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.